The voice of Palawang Shire is 88.9 Braidwood FM.
Grandma, my father's mother, lives behind four Salford walls, like a tin and wrinkled prune, drawing all a will for living, not from God or man or Guinness, but from ceramic souvenirs and her scrapbook of fluffy kittens she'd collected throughout the years. And knocking 90 come next April, Granny Ma, my father's mother, cures her aching and her paining with olive oil and black molasses, wears as many woolly jumpers as there are layers to the onion which she cooks and bakes for supper in a cast iron fireside oven. And now I've left you knitting bed socks for the coming Salford winter, Granny Ma, my father's mother. I see a hazy ancient army of bygone slow-motion generations, each with tins of black molasses, holding close their goodbye lifetimes, sitting frail behind lace curtains.
Hello, hello.
And that was a poem by Dennis Wilde, who is our special guest on our occasional interviews today. Dennis, are you hearing me okay?
Yes, I can hear you, Rob, yeah.
Yeah, that's terrific. That is a very, very moving and beautiful piece of poetry. What inspired you to write that?
Well, my grandma, who was a rather eccentric lady, she... After she died, I wanted to remember her, and I've always had this inclination towards poetry, and I just sat down, and I think that took me about half an hour to write. And the interesting thing about that poem is that when I reread it 40 years later, are those three lines: I see a hazy ancient army of bygone slow-motion generations, each with tins of black molasses, holding close their goodbye lifetimes. And I think you would agree, Rob, that as we grow older, we hold our goodbye lifetimes close to us, and we don't always feel too easy about things that are happening in the now, especially when technology is moving so fast. And that's what my PhD is about. It's about that sort of distancing and dislocation between generations, largely due to technology.
And it's an incredibly interesting area that you know, you've said.
Hello,
to me,
are you there, Rod?
Yeah. Can you hear me, Dennis?
I've lost you, Rod. The volume is so low, I can't hear you.
Okay, how's that? Any better?
That's a lot better, lot better.
Okay, good. My apologies for that.
That's fine.
It's a fascinating area that you've chosen to make your thesis in, and I'd like to kick off that wonderful photograph that you sent me of the Manchester baby age 2, which was you, and the Manchester baby.
Yes, yeah. Well, lots of people believe that the digital world actually began in Manchester, Northern England, which is where I was born, on June the 22nd of 1948, when I was 2 years old. The world's first computer that was sitting in the basement of Manchester University took something like 13 minutes to calculate some equation. And it held the answer in its own memory, and that was the first time that had ever happened. So, like the digital world, if you take the Manchester baby, that's what they called the machine, the Manchester baby. I mean, I'm just a Manchester baby. The machine was the Manchester baby. That's where it all began. That's where the digital world began.
And you've chosen to undertake this thesis much later in life than many, many people would. But then that must give you the perspective to be able to carry this through, because I think part of the base of the thesis is that the digital age is so quick, so fast, and we come from, in a way, another time.
That's right. The baby boomers, I'm a first wave baby boomer. If you're born in 45 up to, I think, 1953, you're called a first wave baby boomer. We are the last generation to live in a pre-digital world, to be born in a pre-digital world. So those years, 45, 46, 47, before the Manchester baby ran its calculation, that was the analog, non-digital world that I knew as a little boy, you know. And, well, it took till 1970 before digital watches were on sale in the shops. So the whole of the 50s were really a non-digital era.
It's interesting. Prior to this interview, I was thinking about, well, how have I come into contact with this myself? And I'll tell you a little story that I think will give us something to talk about. After I retired, I used to work at the Australian War Memorial as a sort of a guide, I suppose, for school groups. And there's a special part of the memorial where it's set out so that the children can learn by doing. And in it is a Iroquois helicopter that flew in Vietnam. And I had a very big group, and I had this most gorgeous, I can still picture her, she, gorgeous little year six girl. And she was obviously very intelligent and very taken by the helicopter. And when everybody else had sort of moved on, she grabbed me by the sleeve and she said, "Sir?" I said, "Yes." She said, "How did it ever fly?" And I said, "What do you mean, sweetie?" She said, "There's no digital readouts." How do you explain levers and Bowden cables to somebody who doesn't know what they are?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I used to sit by the coal fire back in Manchester as a little lad, listening to things on the radio, and it was full of red-hot valves. You know, you could put your hand behind the radio and feel the heat coming out of the back of the radio. Those were the analog days.
The question, though, is, and what I think you're exploring is, what stands to be lost in this disconnect?
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. You put the hit the nail on the head there. There are many things that we do lose. I mean, lots of these digital social media products, platforms like Facebook and Twitter, etc., we have the intelligence and the cleverness to create these things, but nobody can see down the line what the implications will be. And nobody can see that in 10 years' time, teenagers will be 7 hours a day looking at their screens. And as a consequence, when you're looking at the screen for 7 hours a day, what are you not doing? What are you not doing? And one of the main things we're not doing is talking to one another. We're not conversing. And we are not conversing intergenerationally. I used to sit by the fire and have long talks with my granddad and my grandma. They are just such rich memories. I just don't think that in 50 years' time, the young ones will be sitting around in their armchairs or wherever, recollecting their hours and thousands of hours at the screen as rich memories. They will just disappear. And that's what's lost. The intergenerational communication, that's what's lost. There's a man called Kranzberg, and his first law of technology reads, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. You know, I think that's so clever.
It is clever.
And there's a lovely man called Steve Redhead, who was a lecturer at our Flinders University, and he wrote, "Moreover, what are the gigabytes doing to us? What are the gigabytes doing to us? Will they tear us apart or bring us together?
Exactly.
That is a prophetic question.
And the richness of the knowledge of previous generations,
yes,
it's not being passed on.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And to me, that's a tragedy. There's a philosopher called Hannah Arendt who says that to discover our humanity, we need to talk to one another. It's only, she says, it's only by talking to one another, either within generations or across generations, that we discover our humanity. That actually, culture is generational continuity. I'm actually looking at what they call, the best phrase of my research is generational discontinuity. The ruptures that occur between generations as a consequence of fast-moving, accelerating technology. And culture, rich culture, and our humanity is eroded if we are not talking to one another, if we're not communicating. If we just live in a 21st century digital bubble, then something falls away. Life becomes less than. That's what I believe, and that's what I'm studying.
Well, I think that, you know, as I almost made it into the first wave of baby boomers, being a 54 birth, but the reality is, too, that there's a danger. I'll put this to you, and I'd appreciate your opinion on this. There seems to be, as we age and there's fewer of us, which is the natural order of things, but increasingly there is this idea that we all understand how to use computers, we all understand how to navigate around websites, we all understand how to hook up modems, and that's simply not true for our generation.
No, it's not true. You're right. And even if you actually think you're on top of it, you're not, because there's all this subterfuge happening behind this. What you call persuasive technology. So millions of dollars have gone into research to try and make you take the next click. They try and navigate you to where they want you to navigate, to go to see adverts or whatever. So every screen is designed not for your sake, but for their sake. And we think we're in control, but actually it's the program and screen designers who are largely telling us where to go. And that to me is like a gross incursion into my life as a person who wants to develop in fully in all directions, not in their direction.
That's a very interesting way of putting it. Now, you wrote a poem, you call it the slam poem, I think, and
yeah.
it actually, there's a little story to that, because you won an award with that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Here at Flinders University, we have what's called a doc fest. A doctoral festival where all the PhD students and master's students come together. We even have a dinosaur dancing competition. There's some humor to it, but also it's a chance to actually share your research with other doctoral students and meet them, because often a PhD is a lonely occupation. You're often just sitting at a desk, reading and researching. So our wonderful OGR department, the Office of Grad Research, I call them my beautiful ogres, OGR. I put an E on the end. They have helped me in every way, whenever I've stumbled and whatever. They are there to help, you know. Because as a late lifer, you know, you just need some help along the way. And so the OGR department, the Office of Grad Research, led by Tara Brabazon, who puts vlogs out every week, which are just marvellous. They had this poetry competition, a slam poetry competition. And so I had to do the research. Slam poetry came from Chicago in the 1990s. It's like a young people's art form. It allowed the young people to stand up and for 3 minutes tell their truth or talk about their concerns. And it's you probably know that it's gone worldwide. It's so popular. And so they had a slam poetry competition. And I'll read out the three rules. To describe your PhD project in a slam poetry style, 3 minutes maximum, and to describe the new knowledge that your project will create. And that's what a PhD is all about. It's about creating new knowledge. So are you saying, Rod, do you want me to read this out?
I certainly would, yes.
Well, look, it's in two parts, really. The first part, you know, when you come to university, there are certain words, I call it uni-speak, which you sort of get used to after a while. And part one of this slam poem is what they call the ontological introduction. Ontology is all about what's the meaning of life? What's it about being? What's this being all about? But then I move into slam proper, what I call the hip-hopological movement. The hip-hopological, so I've got the ontological and the hip-hopological, and it speeds up a bit, the rhythm moves on in the second part. Okay, here I go. Are you ready?
We're ready.
Here we go. I didn't choose to be born a baby boomer. I could have been Gen X, Gen Y, or maybe one sooner. Was it an accident of birth, or maybe destiny's mirth? Or even a heavenly decision that I arrived with the post-World War II boomerlogical burst. But you take what you're given. There's naught else to take. Gen Z or millennial, it's all in the bake. First, there's a bun in the oven. That's the warm pre-birthing stage. Then there's light and there's breathing and the year-by-year journey as we age and we age and we age. And we age. And aging, it brings confusions, whether you're a boomer or not, because we're all in this together from cot onto cot. And one of these confusions that freaks out my today's brains, folks don't do very much talking like in those long, long ago, to talking about my generation pre-internet fab 60s days. But I try. I say, g'day to the screen agers, but then feel all wobbly and phased. What to do when you get that zombified Samsungian stare or that mesmerized, googly-eyed, iPhonical gaze? iPhonical, iPhone, yeah. Now, this is the talking thoughtfully bit that precedes the hip-hop bit. What to do? That's the question. How to wage war against these intergenerational silences? My decision, Flinders Uni. Research, seek understanding, perhaps even create new knowledge. And so here's the hip-hopological movement. I'm here to explore this mega-polarizing psychosociological trend, this digitally disruptive, dehumanizing, disconnecting dead end, which separates us boomers from the butte young of today, leaving everybody the poorer for want of their own generational experiential say. So, and I'm talking to Braidwood now, so, Braidwoodian dudes, whatever your years, lend me your noise on cancelled ears. Let's beware those deep fake virtual reality techniques. Let's not get seduced by those insane I like, you like Facebookian metrics. And now here's the quiet bit. Folks, we've got to hold on to what's fundamentally human. We mustn't let go of what's biologically, essentially everyday real. Because let's not forget that across the wide-ranging age spectrum, we've all got deep-down hearts pumping emotions. And AI-programmed robots, well, they surely don't feel. They surely don't feel. No, surely. Those robots don't feel. AI-programmed robots, they surely don't feel. And then I ended up, this was in the bar with all the dozens or hundreds of people out there, and I gave them an opportunity to join in. So I ended up with this, because this is what my project's about. My project is about trying to improve intergenerational empathy. So I end up, Rod, with this. So give me an I, and they all shout back. I, and give me an E. E, they all shout. I'm talking about intergenerational empathy. So give me an I, and give me an E. I'm talking about intergenerational empathy. Empathy. That's it, Rod. That's the one.
I really do like that. I think that it sums it up, intergenerational empathy.
So, yeah, in a way that poem actually says it all. That's what I'm about. You know, I mean, I could quote the stuff I'm reading and marvelous stuff I'm reading, but really that poem is a distillation of everything I'm doing. And it's also read about feeling, and I've had to ask myself, how can I write about the feeling that of being feeling estranged or feeling left behind, feeling alienated? And I've decided the way to do it is with poetry, So I'll be including poetry in my thesis as a way of communicating that whole sense of a late life of being left behind.
And I think that comes across really, really well. We've been talking about the things that are lost and the things that are gained. I was thinking to myself as I was listening to the poem, I remember a time when we didn't have a telephone. You used to go down to the telephone box on the corner with button A and button B. I never did find out what button B did. And that's where you made your telephone call. And you did it sparingly. You're right, there was a much greater degree of person-to-person communication.
In those days, yes, that's what we knew. Yeah. That was our normal. The new normal is that you stand at a bus stop and there's 10 people, and 9 out of 10 are looking at their mobiles and nobody's talking to one another. Teenagers have become screenagers. And the makers of Facebook, the clever people who designed Facebook and Twitter, etc., they would never have known that the social implications were that teenagers would become screenagers. Never, never. We haven't got the wisdom. We cannot foresee the implications down the line.
So it's a juggernaut moving at great pace with nobody at the helm.
It is. It's accelerating. And I'm reading some beautiful people, mostly French theorists, like a man called Paul Virilio, who says speed is a violence. It's a violence. And as such, many of us are bruised along the way, living in a hyperculture. Mm. We're living in a hyperculture. And we have never lived at such a speed before. It's exciting. It's exciting. But somehow we're losing something of what is, as the poem says, we're losing something of what is essentially human.
It's interesting too. I watch my own children who can send a text message at a speed that a plotter like me finds very difficult to do. But they've also changed the English language doing. They've changed it enormously.
Yes, they have. They've got their own language, which again is a separating thing. I was talking to somebody, a family friend, she's only 16. I was about four of us around the table having a coffee. And she was telling me, in this world, I don't want to have children. And six out of seven of my friends never want children. And I said, what do you want? And she said, I want body mods. Body mods.
Body
and
mods.
I said, what's a body mod? And she said, it's like silicon chips that we can put under our skin. She said, I don't want to wait for evolution. Evolution's going too slowly. I want to be a superhuman. And I'm saving my money up to get some body mods. So she's actually saying, generationally, I don't want to be a mother to the next generation. Well, I can understand that, because with the ecological disasters and, you know, species extinction, I can understand that. But I can't understand that she wants to become a superhuman. Human condition 2.0 is only ever going to be less than what we know. We might gain something. We might be able to flick our fingers and a door might be able to open automatically so we don't have to touch the handle. But we lose a lot.
We do. We're just about out of time, and I've so thoroughly enjoyed this interview. We may look at having you back at another time, Dennis, perhaps a bit further along with your research. But I know you wanted to end today with a little piece of poetry by an Indigenous person.
Yeah, well, it's not a poem. It's actually, we had an art exhibition at the Adelaide Art Gallery about 2 years ago, an Indigenous art exhibition. And the main poster was a picture, a beautiful picture of John Mawinjul. And the title was I Am the Old and the New. And he's a bark painter. And this is what he says. The old ways of doing things have changed into the new ways. This was on the poster. The old ways of doing things have changed into the new ways. The new generation does things differently. But me, I have two ways. I am the old and the new. And can I say, Rod, that in my PhD, I've got it written down here, I'd like to finish off by saying, in researching early 21st century generational discontinuity, I'm hoping that one day many more of us will be able to say, I am the old and the new. I am the new and the old. That they're not mutually exclusive. They don't have to be exclusive. We can build that bridge across generations, and we can just enjoy each other's differences and not separate ourselves.
I think that's a wonderful point at which to break off for now, Dennis. Thank you so much for volunteering. I know it can be a daunting thing, but for volunteering to come on air and talk about your thesis and talk about something that I think we've all sort of thought about, but not in the way that you're expressing it. It's a much clearer view of the disconnect and just where we're the knowledge that we don't really know where we're heading, I suppose. Look, can I thank you again? And
yes, absolutely.
And I hope you have a lovely day. And I'll talk to you again.
And goodbye from Flinders University, South Australia.
Indeed.
And if there's any late lifers out there who want to be part of higher ed, well, we're here and we would welcome you. Lots of people are doing it remotely.
That sounds like a very good offer. And I must say, Flinders University are very forward-thinking in promoting these interviews in the way that they have. Dennis, keep well, and I'll be in touch soon.
Thank you, Rod. Bye-bye.
Bye, mate.